Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Daphne Papouthaki. Daphne is a research fellow at the Institute of Employment Studies, and she's the co-author of an excellent new report entitled Moving Out to Move On, Understanding the Link Between Migration, Disadvantage and Social Mobility, which is the subject of today's discussion. Daphne, welcome to City Talks.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So it's a fantastic report. It's full of insights and analysis, and we'll dive into the findings and then, I suppose, some of the implications from a policy point of view in a moment or two. But before we do that, just set out for us what the report is focused on, and then I suppose the approach that you used in order to explore the issues.
Yes. So this report is a project that is part of the Social Mobility Commission's mission to create a fairer Britain. And it is focusing on the link between internal migration and disadvantage and social mobility, effectively. So the issues here are multiple, and they link in different ways, and they have different levels, of course. So on the one hand, we have social mobility. We have people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, so people whose parents are from a social class that's relatively lower. And we look at their trajectories and how their social class is determined over the life course and during the most prime years of work. And at the same time, we're looking at how geography relates to that. So when we look at social mobility, obviously a person's socioeconomic class is really dependent on their parents' background to a great extent. And there are drivers that can affect the social class other than the socioeconomic background of a person. That would be education most of the time. So having the opportunity to study to a university or a good university or continue further education is a way definitely to boost your salary and your occupational status. At the same time, what we know already is that opportunity is segregated. So not all areas in the country have the same opportunities. So not all areas have places for people to study or of similar quality, institutions of different quality. And of course, the job opportunities are not the same, and also the career opportunities are not the same, the types of jobs. Now, this report brings the two together in the sense that it looks at not only how does the geography affect you when you're born in a specific place, but is it possible for you to move from one place to another, a place of fewer opportunities, and help you have a better career, a better socioeconomic trajectory than you would have otherwise or you have otherwise. The issue here is that obviously, like with anything else, like even with education, and I'll go back to that in a second, this topic can be both positive and negative. So the fact that you move, the fact that people move from a more disadvantaged area can potentially lead to a higher socioeconomic status if the people who move come from all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds. But what if people from higher socioeconomic backgrounds are the ones that predominantly move? That is going to lead to further segregation. And what if the moves are one way? So what if the moves are predominantly of people who go away to study, they go to a more affluent area and they remain there and they build their careers there, they buy their house there, they boost the economy there. So that is further depriving areas that were not so good in the first place, even further. So there are potential problems. And that's actually something that we see that happens with education as well. Even though education and educational levels have increased the last years in the country, inequality hasn't decreased, and it's actually many times people from richer families, from better socioeconomic backgrounds, that get the best education, and that might actually make things even worse. So it is a very complicated issue.
So let's explore different aspects of the report and the work that you did. And I want to start off, Daphne, getting your reflections on and what the findings were in relation to where people are moving to or not. So the geography question, because rightly you kind of think about where people are moving or not, who is moving or not, why they're moving or not, and then what the outcomes and experiences are. So let's kind of run through those in that order, and just say something about where people are moving to, and more particularly the different frameworks that you used, using deprivation on the one hand, and obviously the hot and cold spot work that the Social Mobility Commission had already done previously. So just say something about where people are moving to or not.
Yes. So one part of the project, the part that looked at internal migration flows, it investigated whether people move from poorer places effectively to richer places, places of fewer opportunities, and to places with more opportunities. The first strand of this, it looked at the areas, the local authorities more specifically, based on their level of deprivation. And we broke areas into five quintiles, and we looked at internal migration flows between those five quintiles to understand better which areas are more likely to experience higher outflows and where those flows are directed to. So looking at the deprivation levels, we saw that the outflows are sort of U-shaped. So you have higher outflows both from the highest deprivation areas and both from the lowest deprivation areas. And then when looking at the direction of those flows, we saw that actually the flows are quite segregated themselves. So you have moves from the most deprived areas to other areas, other local authorities that are equally deprived. And you have moves between areas of low deprivation predominantly. Now, this was interesting on its own, but then we wanted to understand better some of the drivers of those flows. So in our subsequent analysis, we found that some of the most important drivers of differences between flows were the housing costs and the relative opportunities in the areas, economic opportunities. So when I say economic opportunities and relative economic opportunities, I mean the unemployment levels of the sending areas and the receiving areas, and also the productivity levels of the sending areas and the receiving areas. So those were very important explanatory variables when it came to flows.
How did they interact? So take productivity or housing costs. What's the interaction on those two variables between the send and the receive? And then how does that play with a, you know, kind of cross cut on deprivation or an issue?
Yes.
So you can unpack that is, yes. Let's go productivity first.
So the productivity variable that we used was the gross value added per capita. So this variable is a good indicator to compare areas between each other, and not so good to understand as an absolute value, of course, but it is a good measure to understand where one area stands in terms of productivity with respect to another. And obviously, because the level of deprivation is a measure that it's an index that it's created taking into consideration a series of variables that also incorporate the local economies, we can see how the outcome variable of deprivation and this specific variable of productivity are very strongly related. And then also unemployment in the same manner, unemployment levels are also very highly related with deprivation as this part of how this index is created. So we can see how they are related to your characterization of an area, but it's also furthermore, it's related to the moves between those areas, as we saw. And basically, the idea behind this was that when someone is making the decision to migrate, what they do, or at least what we assume that is happening, is that they compare their potential earnings in the area they want to go to and the potential earnings in the area they are at the moment. And they subtract from this the costs of the move. So the costs, the financial costs, the psychological costs, the emotional costs. So all this together defines the decision to migrate. So,
yeah. But you're not, and you, but you didn't find, because this is the kind of, in the classic assumption in some respects is on a kind of labor market mobility view.
Yes.
What you didn't really observe is significant migration out of deprived areas into non-deprived areas.
Yes.
Is that right? In a sense, you saw much greater migration from a deprived area to a deprived area, and also from a non-deprived area to another non-deprived area. So in a sense, the overall conditions stay the same. It's just it's migration within the deprivation quintiles rather than across them. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. People were four times more likely to move from a high deprivation area to a high deprivation area rather than to a low deprivation area. So that shows that potentially things like differences in housing costs are really, really affecting those decisions. And eventually you have those moves that are between areas of similar deprivation that shows that potentially this flow is not really helping mobility in the sense of helping people from richer areas bring their knowledge and money to.
I thought that was a fascinating insight. I think you say somewhere in the report, people migrate from poor areas, but are four times more likely to go to areas with similar or higher levels of deprivation than they are to go in essentially somewhere where considerably lower levels of deprivation, which is a challenging finding in the sense of thinking about labor market mobility as being one of the ways that we equalize or more equalize opportunity across the country, and has all the kind of implications that you've talked about. What about from the, as I said earlier on, from the hot and cold perspective? So just, you probably need to say a little bit about what the hot and cold spots are, because that's a pre-existing idea from the Social Mobility Commission. And then again, did you see similar relationships between more cold to cold than cold to hot and vice versa?
Yes. So the Social Mobility Commission created a social mobility index that uses a series of indicators that promote social mobility at different stages in life, from the early years, education, employment, and later years. And it helps us group areas into areas that have what it takes to have higher social mobility and areas that don't so much. And what they did is that they separated the local authorities into those areas, and the top 20% of the areas at the index of social mobility, the most mobile socially areas, are the hotspots, and the areas that 20% of the areas that are at the lower end are the cold spots. And now, for the needs of our report, we called what is in the middle medium spots. So that's on us. That's not the Social Mobility Commission's fault.
Or lukewarm is probably not the proper thing. It's a fair compromise rather than, you know, lukewarm.
Oh, well. So again, here we saw segregation in the moves. We saw that outflows from hotspots were predominantly to other hotspots and then to medium spots, and the least likely to the cold spots. Similarly, outflows from medium spots were to medium spots, so similar levels again of social mobility based on this indicator. And then when it came to cold spots, we had a higher rate of outflows towards medium spots, and then the next one was towards cold spots. However, of course, we have to consider that this later on was better investigated with regression analysis, because obviously just the descriptive is highly affected by the relative sizes of these areas.
Yeah.
The split. And what we also saw was that the most mobile areas in terms of outflows were the hotspots, which was interesting. Now, within these groups, we also looked at the age profiles of people who were moving. And most of the moves took place at the early 20s of people, which is normal and what we would expect as people go away to study. Lots of medium spots are university cities. And then we have another interesting spike when it comes to late 20s and early 30s between hotspots, which might be related to professional moves. And then finally, we also looked at the moves between men and women. We saw this at the analysis of the aggregate data using those ONS external migration flows. But we also saw it later on when we did the secondary data analysis as well, that women have higher migration rates than men. And that might be also related to the fact that women are more likely to study for an undergraduate degree, yeah. I think, at this stage. So
yeah. And so you talked a little, and obviously the point on the deprivation issue, although that's slightly more mixed, but certainly on the hot and cold spots, is that, you know, they're not equally distributed across the country. They tend to be clustered in, you know, hot spots tend to be clustered, not exclusively, but tend to be clustered in and around the greater southeast, and the colder spots tend to be clustered, or they're more prominent in the mids and then Midlands and through into the north. Yeah. So yes, there's a kind of geographical distribution of those hot and colds, and obviously deprivation and non-deprivation that is also playing into the thoughts of us when we're thinking about what the policies might be to respond.
Exactly, yes. And we did try, I must say that, we did try to look at the moves between hotspots, cold spots and medium spots, excluding London as well. We saw similar flows. However, we didn't include that because obviously a lot of the hotspots are in London, and that decreased our sample size by a lot, so we didn't present this, but we did see similar patterns as there are still some hotspots of the biggest and most vibrant and economically active cities up north.
Yeah, okay. So you've touched on it a couple of times. Just sort of fill this out. The question as to who is moving, or more particularly the characteristics of the person that is moving, and I suppose on the flip side, the characteristics of the person who's not moving. You said something about age, so younger are more likely to be moving than older. There is an element of women are more likely to move than men, particularly at that younger age because of the study issue. Education is a factor. You talked a little bit about that. Those on the way to degrees, I suppose, are more likely to move, and that's reflecting they move to study and then they often stay where they are. Mm-hmm. What other sort of personal or demographic issues related to the individual did you observe as being important to say something about who does move or who doesn't move?
So I think this question is best answered if I combine some of the findings from our qualitative research and our secondary data analysis. So I would like at this point just to very briefly talk about these different parts of the research,
yes,
basically, to explain it so it makes more sense. So we used mixed methods in this project, which means that we had both a large qualitative part in the analysis and also quantitative part for the analysis. So the qualitative part meant that we held focus groups all across Great Britain, in predominantly in more disadvantaged areas, cold spots. And then we also held some focus groups in more affluent areas such as London, Cardiff, and Edinburgh. And we try to cover a wide range of ages as well to understand better the trajectories and differences in the generations, get a bit better view of what's happening. And we also did some interviews, about 40 interviews, with people who moved from cold spots to hotspots, or people who moved between hotspots and people who remained in cold spots, to understand, to dive even deeper, and understand even better the choices and people's trajectories. And at the same time, apart from looking at the internal migration flows on an aggregate level, we also looked at secondary data, the Understanding Society and the census, to understand the trajectories of people, well, more like the employment outcomes, I would say, for this one. Yeah. Employment outcomes of people who move and people who stay in the area where they grow up. And we use the similar way of defining movers and stayers. So a mover is a person who grew up in one area. So they found themselves in an area whilst they were teenagers and then moved away perhaps to study or to work. And when we observe them again at the age of 25 and over, they are somewhere else. They're in a different place than where they grew up. A stayer, on the other hand, is somebody who again grew up in an area as a teenager. They are allowed to have gone away to study. So a person who went away to study but came back, that's a stayer. A person who never left is also a stayer. So that allows us to actually look at the number of people who got a higher education but remained in the area where they grew up effectively, and not just separate movers and stayers based on whether they are currently studying or not. Yeah. Even though they were the focus groups interviewees, some of them were quite young, so they were still at the point where they were still studying and their decisions were still being determined at the moment. Anyways, so moving to the characteristics then of the movers, and what we saw was, first of all, movers were much more highly educated than stayers. So obviously that came from the secondary data analysis, and those are all people over the age of 25 when it came to the secondary data analysis. And even people who went away and studied and came back to the place where they grew up, they were still, including those, they were still less likely to have a higher degree than the movers on average, which makes sense. You move away, you go to a city to study, and then a job opportunity comes up. You get used to the different lifestyle and you get a job there. Perhaps your degree is also more relevant there because of the opportunities. And this was the first thing that was very striking, but also highly expected. And the second characteristic of the movers was that they came from very much higher socioeconomic backgrounds than the stayers. So we looked at movers who moved from any type of area, whether that was a hot spot or a cold spot, a deprived area or a not so much deprived area, to any other area, and still the movers were the ones with a higher socioeconomic status. But also when we looked at moves out of more deprived areas, again, the movers were two times more likely to be from a higher socioeconomic status than the stayers. And that difference was actually higher when we looked at moves from more deprived areas than when we looked at any kind of move. So that was also a very interesting finding. But our understanding of this was enhanced when we looked at the qualitative analysis. So the movers, they were asked at some point during the interviews whether they knew people from their area who had also moved. And most of them did know people who moved. They knew people who moved to study or work. Right. And they had people in other cities at the time that were working and living there in the city that they were in or other cities. On the other hand, stayers, they were much, much less likely to know people who had moved. And that also might show that what you're exposed to, what your social cycle is doing, is also affecting your decision to study, to go away, to follow a career path somewhere else, to take the risk, apart from all the facilitators of having somebody else in the city that you want to go to, what it might provide in terms of facilitating that move. It is actually a very interesting trend among the movers and the stayers.
Because that's an interesting point around. And it tells us something about that. Obviously, the characteristics within the person are important, but also, as you've talked about already, the family environment that individual is in, that's very important as well. But even beyond that, the community setting in which that individual lives and or experiences their early lives, as it were, is obviously critically important as well in terms of just making things more familiar or more routine than they would otherwise. So I think that again for me was a kind of interesting one, because if we want to if we want to encourage people at least to have the choice of doing so, it's not just about giving that individual more education and more skills on the inside. It's actually about the environment that they, or in the community in which they find themselves, and maybe taking them out of that or bringing more influences in is going to be a critical component of that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, of course, the issue here is that we should also consider is that the stayers, since they're more likely to be predominantly from a lower socioeconomic status, that sort of explains why in our qualitative analysis, most of these people didn't have somebody who went away to study. So there's a correlation, obviously, there. And the other finding from the qualitative research that was very interesting was the fact that the stayers, some of the stayers, had families already from a very young age, and that determined their decision to stay, to remain, because obviously it would be very costly, it would be difficult to support their children in an area where they would have to build a career and a social network, etc. So also the stayers, some of the stayers from the qualitative research at least, were more likely to have families early on.
Yeah. And Daphne, when you were doing the interviews and the focus groups, did you explore, or did this issue around frustration come up from, you know, from the people you were talking to, about either they were frustrated that they wanted to move, but they felt they couldn't because of a variety of reasons, some of which you've just, you know, costs are too high elsewhere, dependents, I have a dependent, so therefore it's not just me, it's my household that would have to move. On the other hand, you know, the flip side, frustration that people felt that they had to move in order to be successful, quote unquote. You know, did you pick up a sort of sense of, or, you know, were people who were staying were happy and the people who were moving are happy, and, you know, we're just describing what's going on, but there's nothing more to say about that. I'm always curious about that, and actually how much we know about the sort of that frustrated element or happiness element to it. Did you explore that?
Yes. So people were not necessarily frustrated. They were not it depended highly on what they wanted from their lives, what kind of lives they wanted to live. And also it depended on whether they lived close to bigger city centers and transport links to those city centers. But it also was affected by the age. So there was some frustration when it came, if we want to look at that specifically, from younger people who would want to move, they would consider moving. However, it was a precarious move in the sense that they had no savings to support them, they had no financial backing to support them, and if they did move, it would increase their uncertainty, financial uncertainty, by a lot. So there was some of that, obviously. But on the other hand, loads of people were very happy with where they were and with what they had. Of course, they felt that things could be better, and we saw how they were getting more and more frustrated with the transportation getting worse, or with the healthcare services getting worse, and some cultural and fun opportunities for them and their families getting more and more expensive and less accessible. And they were parts of their lives that were concerning to them and that could get better, but they didn't necessarily want to move. They were not frustrated by that. They loved their communities. They loved their families and their friends and their network, and they didn't see any reason to do that. But amongst the younger generation, I think there was some level of frustration from some people that actually couldn't do the move.
Yeah, well, that is fascinating, and we can come back to that on from a, because that raises interesting questions on the policy front as to, you know, if you're intervening, on what basis are you intervening, and why that might be. But not just another question. I mean, again, you know, I appreciate can't infer too much from, you know, from the conversations that we've had. You know, you and I, you know, conscious of that. But I'm also interested in whether there was anything noticeable in perspective or outlook from those that had, I suppose, those that had moved away maybe to study but then had returned, you know, in a sense they'd gone away but then they'd returned, or between those and those that had never gone away at all. Did you notice anything there, or is there anything to say on that, in that sort of area?
No, I don't think that something came up from our discussions on that front, to be honest. There were some people that went away to study but cut their studies short and came back, and they were not happy with the way of living in the big city, or felt homesick, and they didn't like their degree. So there was some of that. But yeah, I don't think there was something strong coming out of the experiences of people who went away to study and came back, and those who never went to study.
Yeah, no, quite.
But that doesn't mean that there is nothing there.
No. I know. No, exactly. I mean, I think that's the we can't infer anything, but that the fact that we can't observe that, we didn't observe that, doesn't mean that that issue is not relevant and shouldn't be explored further. You also looked at the actual outcomes for people who stayed or moved, both from a wages point of view and from an employment or likelihood of being in employment perspective. Just say something about, you know, what did you actually observe for those that did move?
So I wouldn't want to call it an effect, because obviously that implies causality, and that's not definitely what we can claim that we identified. But the movers do earn 33% more than the stayers. So there is a difference in earnings. Of course, that goes hand in hand with a higher cost of living, the fact that they're less likely to be house owners, and the higher transportation costs if they are in a big city, etc. But yes, movers do earn more in terms of that specific employment outcome. They're also more likely to be employed than stayers, which could also be partly explained by the fact that they are a selected sample who move to find work.
Of course, yeah.
So obviously that's affected by that too. And then they are much more likely to achieve a higher socioeconomic status than stayers. And also the relation of the socioeconomic status of movers to their parents is not as strong as the one between the stayers and their parents. So people from a lower socioeconomic status achieve a much higher socioeconomic status when they're movers.
And are those findings, are they the same, I suppose, at both ends of the deprivation sort of spectrum? Because obviously we've got non-deprived areas, people moving from non-deprived to non-deprived. I assume that those sort of issues play out there, higher wages, more likely to be employment, shifting in status. Does that also apply for people who are moving from deprived area to deprived area or not?
So because we used the Understanding Society and the sample size was relatively small when it came to looking at moves with that specific characteristic, not just any move, but, you know, this kind of movers that we looked at, we weren't able to break down people from deprived areas and non-deprived areas with the Understanding Society. However, we used the census to do that, but the census does not have information on wages.
No.
So there was a little bit of a lack on that front. But we did say when we used the census, we saw that movers from deprived areas to non-deprived areas, they achieved higher socioeconomic status compared to stayers, even after we controlled for any demographic characteristic that we could control for. For example, their age, gender, educational level, socioeconomic background, etc. So we saw that even after controlling for things that traditionally determine those employment outcomes, the movers still did better than stayers.
Yeah, so that's an interesting one in a sense. If you turn to the sort of policy implications, because I think it's an interesting one as to whether encouraging mobility should be an explicit policy objective. And, you know, you and I know, I've been involved in these sort of conversations, you know, people to jobs, jobs to people, you know, mobility as a, you know, as a kind of objective in and its own right. But it's a kind of interesting one. So mobility does seem to be an enabler of, at the individual level, of in some instances, shifting the individual to a higher wage and to have more likely to be in employment, you know, more higher kind of socioeconomic status. So there's a, you know, policy question there. Get your thoughts on that. But on a geographical issue, you know, what we're also observing is that the actual move from deprived to non-deprived is pretty limited, and it's deprived to deprived or non-deprived to non-deprived. So from a geographical point of view, we may not be getting the equalizing effect that, let's say, the leveling up agenda is, you know, or geographically leveling up agenda is ideally looking for. So I'd love to get your kind of thoughts on at least those two aspects, and we can, you know, expand onto that. But so just, you know, your thoughts on that.
So I don't think that the issue should ever be whether we should leave the deprived areas and just leave and move away so that we can all gain a better employment outcome in any respect. That is not the point. I think I would say two main messages come out of this work. The first message is that we should equalize opportunity on the individual level, in the sense that if someone wants to move, they should be able to move regardless of their background. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that no one should move to be able to have access to opportunities. So opportunities should be accessible wherever someone lives in the UK. And that means supporting the areas that are considered deprived at this point, to offer those opportunities, to give better access to people to such opportunities. Of course, that's not an easy one. It's not an easy task, obviously. And it requires a series of policies that work together, because many times one policy might, if it happens on its own, might lead to negative effects to the people living in an area rather than positive effects. So yeah, it is, yes, it requires a combination of interventions. And it is also something that requires more research. Like, for example, if we think of places that are more deprived, how do we support people living in them have access to opportunity? Is it by investing in each and every city and village in the country, or is it by investing in large city centers and allowing for better connectivity between smaller places surrounding those city centers so that people have access via that? So I think you do some work on that, I believe. And this is
of
a...
Of course, yes.
Yeah. So I think that this is a very important point. So those
but to
two...
To what extent, yes. Though, Daphne, sorry, to what extent do you... Because this is why I was asking about this frustration issue. And actually, we had an event a month or so ago with the Understanding Society and the University of Essex, where we were looking at sort of issues around geographical mobility. And we had a few presentations looking at different aspects, you know, over the long run and motivations. And I asked a similar sort of question to those sort of the researchers that had been doing that. And I don't think that, if I remember rightly, they didn't, it's not that they, well, I mean, they would know if they researched it, but they hadn't, you know, the point was that hadn't been researched sufficiently. So I'm curious as to whether, do we have a sense as to how frustrated or how big the frustration is? You know, your point about if people should be given the choice, and if they want to move away, they should being able to move away, or if they want to stay, they would stay away. I mean, do you have any sense as to how many people are making choices that they don't ultimately want to make?
I cannot say that.
I'm not expecting you to have an answer to that, but I think that's a curious one in my mind.
Yes, I don't think that such a feeling came strongly.
Because I get, you know, this is partly the sort of issue I hear a lot about, you know, in a geographical sense, people saying, you know, all the opportunities in the cities and sort of places outside and denuded of those sorts of opportunities, and we need to create more opportunities in everywhere. And I definitely have some sympathy to that, although I think there are some limitations genuinely from a policy point of view as to what we can actually do. But I'm always curious about whether we have any sense as to whether people move in because they have to and they're frustrated or disappointed that they have to, rather than they want to. I don't know. What's your
right view? Right. No, I don't think that this came out that people were disappointed that they had to move because of the lack of opportunities. And however, they did miss their families, and it was an issue that was getting more and more serious as and I expect it will be more serious and more intense as someone grows older, because they will have at some point perhaps caring responsibilities towards
yes.
their parents, etc. They did feel that having a reference point from a smaller, cheaper area, we did see that people who moved into bigger cities felt that transportation costs and housing costs were much, much higher and sort of unaffordable at times. But this, I believe, would be the feeling of people living in a city already. And
yes.
And the fact that even if you have, in many cities, you might have some good transportation links, they're not that great. And there are clusters of the city that are actually not really able to access opportunities within the same city at the end of the day. So, yes, I think that I don't expect this sort of frustration, this part, frustrations that have something to do with the big cities that are only relevant to movers. But two things were relevant to movers: missing their families and their networks, and secondly, feeling when they came from a place that was cheaper, feeling even more that where they are currently is very expensive.
Yeah, and that is one of the downsides of economic success, mm-hmm. as we observe it across. Well, not only in the UK, the most economically successful, you know, define that as you wish, place are also nearly always the most expensive places to live. And in a sense, there are growth constraints, which policy actively encourages, makes it worse by, for example, not building enough homes or not providing enough affordable housing, or, you know, outside of London, not running efficient and effective transportation systems that are trying to reduce the costs, because public mass transit is, as you know, as effective as it is in London. So I think, you know, that is all, there's always that sort of trade-off in some respects, and sometimes policy decisions make that worse. We exacerbate the cost of living pressures in somewhere like London by not intervening on a policy front in order to try and do something substantively about that.
Yes. It has to do, of course. That's not so much on top of
that. No, but yeah. And well, also, you know, which I always find a bit strange, but nevertheless kind of interesting, is if you look at sort of the well-being and happiness data, particularly at the local scale, there doesn't seem to be a relationship with, you know, economic success, again, defined as you wish, and, you know, higher levels of well-being in some, or happiness. Seems to be almost, London seems to be the most miserable, you know, place in the country. You know, people living in the countryside seem to be happy, but I think it's an interesting sort of discussion, and, you know, ultimately, what are we trying to achieve, and therefore, what are the levers that we've got, but also what are the, as you know, what are the trade-offs involved in, for individuals as well as for places about doing that. And, you know, there isn't anywhere in the country that is kind of at the aggregate level economically successful and affordable, right? I mean,
yes,
it just isn't.
Yes, that is true. You know,
from your point of view, Daphne, from the work that you've been doing in this sort of space, where does that leave us, in a sense, on a social mobility, or and the role of sort of mobility migration within that? I mean, what's your kind of takeaways on, or where would you like the sort of the policy debate or the research agenda to go next?
Mm-hmm. So we definitely need to tackle the barriers that people face when they want to move somewhere to study or to work. They should not face at least the financial barriers that they're currently facing. They should be able to deal with those with some support, so opportunity in that sense is equal between people, regardless of their financial state and socioeconomic background. But also, we should focus on place and how we can support places to offer more opportunities to people who are there, and so that they don't have to move. They choose to if they do so. Because I would like to add here, when it comes to, because we did talk very briefly about the quality of life, that some people move to bigger city centers just because of the inclusivity and diversity and the lifestyle. So some people might just want to move, not just for the job but in the career, but because it's a different lifestyle, and not necessarily only young people. It's a person related aspect anyways. But when it comes to place opportunity, we should make sure that everybody has the opportunity to get training and a better education, regardless of where they are at, where they find themselves. And there should also be a local labor market that offers opportunities. So giving a good education, a good training to people is not enough. We obviously need those people to find jobs that pay well. So perhaps something that has happened and has been happening in the past, more public sector jobs to other places and not so centralized in specific city centers down south, and also employers to support other ways of working. So, for example, especially now with COVID, we can see how many different types of jobs that are desk jobs can happen remotely. So perhaps a commuting that's not intense, but meeting every so not often with the rest of the team, if there is a good working environment established already, could actually help people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds that don't have the means to support themselves in a bigger city to actually get access to such jobs. And of course, it has everything to do with the local infrastructure, because you might have the institutions, you might have the jobs, but you also need the good links between areas, and you need the veins of the city to be in place, if you like. So you need areas to be connected. You need good connectivity within each city and town, but also between cities and towns. Affordable connectivity.
No, absolutely right. And you know, we could have a whole another conversation about the impact of COVID and the pandemic and the lockdown, and what that means for places across the country working from home, and how the labour market will change, how migration patterns may or may not change. But I think maybe that's for another time. My guest today has been Daphne Papazaki. Daphne, thanks very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved.